are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents, and students worldwide.
You know, the first thing to think about with the internet is that the internet was created on the premise that all users are equal. This is not true. Some are more vulnerable than others.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Dr. Mary Aitken, author, professor, and cyber psychologist, specializing in criminal and deviant behavior online. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are the cyber effect and how it plays a part in all our lives, how parents' screen times affects their children's ability to bond with others, and the ways in which the UK is championing safety tech.
Hello, everyone. This is Ross at Teacher Talk, at the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today, I am delighted and honoured to be joined by Mary Aitken, an Irish cyber psychologist who specialises in lots of interesting things on technology and human behaviour. And my particular interest is on Mary's work on her book, published in 2016, I think, Mary, The Cyber Effect. Yes. Mary, good morning. How are you?
Great, thank you.
So could I just ask you to introduce yourself to listeners to make sure I haven't missed anything important?
Yes, yeah, so it's Dr. Mary Aitken. I'm an adjunct professor at the Geary Institute for Public Policy at University College Dublin, and an associate professor in the Department of Law and Criminology at the University of East London. So basically, cyber psychology is the study of the impact of technology on human behavior. My specialist area is forensic cyber psychology, which is the study of criminal, deviant, and abnormal behavior online. And unfortunately, I'm kept very busy.
Yes. No, I've picked up your book through my own kind of doctoral studies in social media, and I was blown away pretty much from the beginning of the chapter. So I've spent during lockdown on my dog walks getting through your book, and it's been fascinating. I think there's an entire alphabet of content, and I do think it particularly suits teachers. And I know you're not a specialist in education per se, but we could talk about just general safeguarding and your research and finding. I know it's a huge field, so it'll probably not be very helpful in terms of narrowing it down. But Henry?
Well, I think it's good to start broad. So I've been involved in a dozen different research areas, everything from cyber babies, the impact of technology on the developing child, right through to hardcore cyber criminality, you know, the dark nets on the dark web, in my work with Europol. So I'm an academic advisor to Europol, to the EC3, to the Cybercrime Center, also work with the teams at Interpol. And I work at an EU policy level, I work at a UK government advisory level, I'm the academic advisor on the safety tech report that was just published yesterday, but we can come back to that.
Yeah.
And I suppose the reason I've sort of, you know, spread my research interests across all these different silos is because I believe everything is connected. I mean, I did when I finished my, you know, I studied psychology back in the day, literally in the 80s, pre-internet, pre-social media, pre-everything as we know it now.
Yeah.
And I went to work in industry. And so I worked in consumer behavioral marketing and industry. So I didn't go straight into academia. I went to work in industry. And in the 90s, I first came across artificial intelligence in the early 90s. A great friend and colleague of mine, a guy called Rollo Carpenter, who was a brilliant scientist, was working on building the first chatbot.
Right.
And everybody was like, wow, what is this? And I literally met up with him when he had a sort of just a prototype that he was testing. You know, he was beta testing this entity, and he bought this big computer in, and we sat down. And I literally started tapping out a conversation, you know, engaging with this chatbot. So I don't know if any of your listeners have ever tried a chatbot, but they should go to jabberwacky.com. We'll post a link afterward.
Yeah,
because it was fascinating. So I was captivated. I thought this is intriguing. So a chatbot is it's a learning AI that actually responds to you in a conversation. So you can say, what's the weather like? And it'll come back with an answer. And what it does is every person it speaks to, it learns. Mm-hmm. So it builds up this, you know, conversation. And it's got better and better over time. And but those first couple of minutes for me with Jabberwocky, I thought, this is the future.
Mm-hmm.
I just had this very, very strong feeling that this is where we were going to go in terms of communication. So, of course, I went rushing back to my professors of psychology and I said, I've seen the future.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's computer-mediated social communication. I've come across a discipline that's emerging called cyber psychology. So I was very excited. And they literally said to me, cyber hocus pocus.
Right.
Humans don't communicate like that. This will never work. You know, we're hardwired for face-to-face interaction. We're gregarious by nature. And no. You know, people will never socialize in this way. And here we are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we got Google Alexas at home and I've got a little chat box on my website now. Yes, it's an interesting world.
I suppose the thing about it is when I started engaging with the AI, I immediately thought about the potential. You know, I immediately thought, goodness, this could be great for kids with specific learning difficulties or specific engagement difficulties. Mm-hmm. Or maybe children who are on the autism spectrum, or maybe people suffering from social isolation. So immediately I saw the possibilities. And almost simultaneously, I realized, well, just a minute, maybe this might be the worst thing they could do. You know, maybe this would just reinforce isolation, or maybe it would, you know, compromise ability to communicate face-to-face going forward for those who are having difficulties in that area. So again, it was another sort of moment where I thought, goodness, nothing in my training in psychology to date equips me to understand this type of profound and pervasive technology. Mm-hmm. And that's the point that I went back and started looking at the literature, came across cyber psychology, and I thought, yeah, this is what I want to do. So I left my very well-paid job as a senior vice president of the European board of an American public company,
yeah.
working with huge brands worldwide like Kellogg's and Pepsi, and literally put a rucksack on my back.
And I hope you've come out the other side now, because you're, you know, the book, The Cyber Effect, has been brilliant for me for many reasons, as a teacher, as a parent, as a survivor of sexual abuse, as someone who uses the internet every day and has also, I guess, profited from working hard on social media to create a large audience. I was really interested in your, you know, the screen time advice, the plasticity of the brain and things like that. And there's tons of stuff in there that you mentioned, but could you give listeners just an overview of The Cyber Effect?
Well, coming back to the sort of these different silos, the one thing I have observed, and I say observed rather than scientifically studied, was that whenever technology interfaced with a base human disposition, say like impulsivity,
mm-hmm.
the results tended to be amplified and escalated online. So that was an observation. I mean, I published in an area called cyberchondria, which is a form of hypochondria manifested online. And basically, it's Googling, you know, symptomatology. You have a headache and you start looking about, you know, searching migraine, and you escalate to review morbid and serious content like brain tumor. And you experience anxiety as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And effectively, and everybody one way or another is guilty of doing that. And then there was a condition, cyberchondria by proxy, that I particularly studied, which is Googling the symptoms of others. And this amplification, again, coming back to the idea of joining the dots to connect things, I began to think of it as an effect, as a cyber effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, what about if I gather my thoughts? Because I had done a postdoc fellowship in cyber psychology, and then I had switched disciplines. and done my second year postdoc fellowship in network science on a research project for the White House with scientists from MIT. And then my third year, I had done a fellowship in cybercriminology at Middlesex. And then in my fourth year, I became a fellow in information communication technology at the Institute. So I began to sort of adopt, I suppose, this transdisciplinary approach as a single academic. Mm-hmm. So two things were happening there. I was trying to look at the problem space not through the singular lens of one discipline. So I was trying to be almost transdisciplinary as a single academic. And secondly, I was trying to look at a range of research areas and then make sense of both simultaneously, if that's
yes.
makes sense.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just to write it down. So I started just writing the book in 2014. Mm-hmm. And you know, it took about a year, year and a half to write it. And as I, you know, the caveat, and I'm sure you saw this in the opening chapter, and this is, I suppose, a challenge to academics and scientists worldwide at the moment. I suppose the challenge that I I'll just wind back, because when I was asked to write the book, I was asked by William Morris, a large international agency. They asked me, the television series CSI Cyber had just been commissioned. So there was a lot of excitement. We can double back and talk about that in a minute. But the TV series had been commissioned. And the William Morris reached out to me and they said, "Can you write?" And I said, "Yeah. There are many things that academics can do, and writing, believe it or not, is one of them."
Yeah.
So I said,
"You wrote for the program."
I said, "No, for like a book." They were like, "Could you write like a book thing?" And I said, "Yeah,
sure.
That's what we do. Guess what?
That's what you do.
As scientists, we write." It was so funny. It was like saying to an athlete, "Could you run? Could you do the running?"
Yeah.
I said, "Yeah, I can write." And they said, "But could you write a popular book?" I said, "Yeah, I can write. I've written book chapters and papers. Of course I can write." And they said, "Yes, but can you write a popular book?" So I said, "Well, what's the definition of popular?" And they said, "Well, shorter sentences and less references." And I said, "I can do that."
Yeah,
last one. That sounds... So that's where we started the conversation. I mean, the book was commissioned by a Random House, a publisher within Random House. And I got a chance to really download everything that I was worried about. You know, everybody else was sort of traumatized reading it, but I got a chance to sort of say, it was a time capsule.
Yeah.
And when the book was commissioned, I remember again going to some academic colleagues, and I make this point again because it's important, I think, for teachers listening in terms of you, when you talk to your peer group and you see, you know, is there consensus that this is a good direction or not? I went to, you know, some academic colleagues and I was very excited. And I said, "My goodness, I've been commissioned to write a popular book." And there was almost sneering. And one of them actually said to me, "Oh, Mary, I wouldn't do that. Many a fine career has been ruined by a popular book."
Yes.
Now, this for me is the root of the problem. What does that mean? It means, and I argue this in the opening chapter, you know, I say that as academics, we're very good at using words like arguably, plausibly, logically, mm-hmm. ablies to avoid nailing our colours to the mast. And
you are going to actually express opinions more, don't you?
Exactly. Well, the point is, I'm arguing that academics can't sit on the fence while babies are being born and infants are engaging with smartphones and toddlers are on their iPads and young kids are glued to YouTube. You know, we have to step up and offer an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yes, we will have the longitudinal studies in time, but in the meantime, kids are being born and are engaging with this journey with technology, and their parents desperately need some advice. I'll give you an example. If you were a business consultant and you had an MBA in whatever, you know, some form of marketing, and you went to your client and your client said, "I'd like your opinion on whether we should launch this particular brand in this particular sector or not." And as a business consultant, if you said, well, just a minute, I'd like to do a longitudinal study and I'll come back to you in a decade. Are we good with that?
Of course. You
wouldn't get any work. So I suppose from an academic point of view, what I'm doing is nailing my colours to the mast. Yeah. I'm saying this is what we know now. Yeah. I'm saying based on my qualifications, I have a PhD in cyber psychology. I have a level of expertise. I hold professorships. Minimum requirement is that I should be able to offer some guidance in advance of absolute studies to back up my opinion.
So can I push you for your advice for parents in terms of screen time for toddlers or for young children kind of school age?
So the first thing that I would say to parents and to teachers is that eye contact is critical. Mm-hmm. I think it's the one most important variable, the biggest challenge that we have in terms of screen time. The distractibility that we see in the household, everybody is glued to their devices. The average person picks up their smartphone or device 200 times and touches it a couple of thousand times a day, depending on their usage. Nice. Now, if you are a parent or caregiver to a young child, then that is 200 times you have not picked them up and 2,000 times you have not touched them. Mm-hmm. That is potentially catastrophic for us as a species. There is no study that does not support the importance of eye contact with infants. Mm-hmm. So starting from birth, when parents say to me, I'm concerned about my child and my infant and, you know, what's the best age to introduce them to devices because, you know, all these parents want their kids to be Bill Gates or whatever and be some tech genius. And they operate, not maybe all parents, but some. Yeah. And they operate, I suppose, on the premise that the earlier I introduce them to technology, the more brilliant they will be. But that's not necessarily the case. And in fact, arguably inappropriate and too much exposure to technology at an inappropriate age could actually be very counterproductive in terms of...
You mentioned the term plasticity, it starts to actually shape the brain?
Well, yes, yes. So I'm not a neuroscientist what's her name? Baroness Greenhall has done a lot of Greenfield. Susan Greenfield has done a lot of work in this area. And again, she's somebody who's written books about plasticity, about neural pathways being formed at certain ages, about the sort of, you know, connections that are being made. And my argument is that starting with eye contact, so the child that is deprived of the appropriate amount of eye contact will fail to bond. And children who fail to bond will fail to thrive. And they will be compromised in terms of their relationship through their lifetimes, mm-hmm. in terms of the inability to actually maintain and to create satisfying relationships. So come back to the household when parents say, what's the best age to introduce my child to a screen? The first thing that I say to them is, let's talk about your screen time. Mm-hmm. Because the child is learning in that environment. If you are consumed with your device, you are not making eye contact with your child. You're not looking at your child in the face when you're speaking to them. They are not seeing your expressions, your micro expressions. They're not learning how humans react when they talk to each other. In addition to that, if the older children in the household are consumed by their devices, they're not making eye contact with the younger child. So poor baby's in the corner hoping for the family pet to engage with them in terms of eye contact. And what we see is these problems manifesting as children enter into the educational system. So I've had teachers say to me in the US, actually, that one of the first things they've got to do at a sort of preschool level is sit the kids in a circle and teach them to look at each other.
Incredible.
I mean, that is absolutely tragic. So we can post after this discussion a link to the American Academy of Pediatrics. There's some very good guidelines in terms of early screen time, and not all screen time is the same. So television is relatively passive versus the hyper immersive experience of engaging with digital technology. Even something as simple of the speed as the speed of the scrolling of a screen. Mm-hmm. So I don't know about you, but in my research, occasionally, every time there's a new app comes out, I have to download it onto my phone, irrespective of what it is,
yes.
and engage with it and understand. I went through a TikTok binge at the beginning of the lockdown.
Me too. I gave up.
It started innocently enough, and this is interesting. I'm reading about kids on this. I better have a look at it. And I literally had to wean myself off.
Yeah.
It was...
I've seen some frightening videos in terms of clicks, just, you know, from mock accidents to making fun of their own children.
But it was so compelling and seductive as a technology. And I'm somebody who's clinically experienced, yes, and yet I found it hard to desist. Mm. I also found it exhausting.
Yes.
So, and again, I would put that down to the speed of scrolling of the screen. It's exhausting.
Yeah, 5, 6, 10 second video, isn't it, all the time?
So you mentioned...
Can you talk more about the new paper that you've published, The Safer Technology, with the independent report from the government?
Yes. So basically, you just mentioned their extreme content online, and that's a very, very important area. And it falls into an area that, the first thing to think about with the internet is that the internet was created on the premise that all users are equal. This is not true.
No.
Some are more vulnerable than others. When we go online, there is no shallow end of the swimming pool online. There is no special place for children. You talk about parental controls, but I would say to teachers or to parents, go home and Google bypassing parental controls.
Okay.
You'll get a million results. You won't sleep tonight, but you'll know what your kids know. So the point is that children are very, and young people are very adept at actually, bypassing the sort of technologies we put in place. So the UK government is, I'm thrilled to say, and I work internationally,
mm-hmm.
from the US to the EU to the Far East, and the UK is literally leading the world in this area in terms of taking this, what's happening online, seriously, and seriously in a policy context. So starting with the construct of online harms, and I first started working with DCMS on this 5 years ago, and they've a huge team there and a lot of experts that they've reached out to actually create for the first time a full spectrum of online harm. So the problem is, to date, we've been looking at the space in silos. So we look at cyberbullying over here. We look at sexting over here. We look at coercion and sextortion over here. We look at child abuse material online over here. We look at mis and disinformation over here. And the point is, they're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
So coming back to where I started with the cyber effect, everything is connected. So the UK government have this, they've had this consultation process on online harm, and they've created this spectrum of online harm, including things such as extreme content.
Yeah,
online.
I'm just looking at it now while you talk. It's got from terrorism to unsafe spaces to coercive behavior.
The targeting of public figures online, which in some instances can include teachers who are very well known, or people like you who are, influencers and people who inform in this space, and how you can become a target as a result of even voicing an opinion that might be counter to the cyber mob.
Yes.
So you start with online harm. Now, having identified this, spectrum of online harms, identified and created a classification, which is a giant step forward in cyberspace, this is a big step. The government then moved on to, well, now that we know these harms exist, what are we doing to tackle these harms?
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, a team was commissioned to do an audit of all the technologies that are operating in this space, from network filtering, through to content moderation, to look at companies offering services that could address some of these harms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the report is based on. So we did this audit. We created a taxonomy, a sort of classification structure. And we were very pleasantly surprised to find a thriving sector operating in this space. And the report is a landmark report because what we have done is really carved out this new sector, and we've called it safety tech. So we have fintech, we have reg tech, we have health tech, and now we have safety tech. And the report was just launched yesterday. And after this session with you, I go on to calls with the US, with policymakers in Washington this afternoon to actually start talking about US versions, or calls with people in the EU next week.
Yeah, great.
As far as the Middle and the Far East. So this is fantastic because we're creating this infrastructure to say, this is a new sector. And the point about it is safety tech can use human and machine intelligence to address these problems. Cyberbullying is essentially a big data problem. In other words, the volume, the velocity of it is so large that basically you do need machine intelligence solutions to address something like cyberbullying. The paradox there is that real world bullying is a problem. A harsh word in the playground, you know, a slap, a punch, because there's no evidence. You cannot engage in cyberbullying without leaving a digital trail. How did we ever get to a position that cyberbullying was a greater problem than real world bullying? And everybody jumps in and says, well, you know, privacy, yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm. If you're an adult, but children are particularly vulnerable. So we can set up machine intelligent technologies to track and address cyberbullying. Mm-hmm. We can do it as an opt-in with parental approval to have their child's traffic monitored anonymously. Mm-hmm. We can design applications whereby anomalies in the behavior, if you think about cyberbullying in a mathematical context as an equation, the first element in the equation is C, content, bitch, hate, die. Mm-hmm. The second element is direction. I'm bullying you, so it's coming from me to you. The third element is frequency and then interval. One text may not constitute a pattern of cyberbullying, but a massive volume all of a sudden of data heading towards your child could send an alert to a parent to say something is going on. You need to talk to your child.
Mary, I could, honestly, you're a very busy person. I could talk to you all day. I'll sit in the room.
No, and I'm okay time-wise. We can go on for another bit.
I'm gonna fire loads of quick fire questions because I keep my podcast about 20 minutes for teachers who don't have much time anyway. But it's fascinating stuff, and I'll definitely share on my network the safety tech taxonomy because I'm looking at it now as we speak, and it looks very, very interesting.
And I'll just say one thing about it is that the best solutions are win-win solutions. Here, with safety tech as a sector, we get a chance to build business, create jobs, protect people, and at the same time address online harms, create a better cyber society and a safer cyberspace.
Fantastic. I'm going to fire loads of quick fire questions at you. I don't want you to pause or hesitate, and we'll see. I'll see if I can stump you out. Okay, what were you like at school?
Great student.
Okay, great.
Overachiever.
If you weren't in lockdown, where would you be where would you be around the world working right now?
I would be on the road, probably working on the professional talk circuit and usually in a different country every week or second week.
If I had 24 hours in Dublin, where should I go?
Out of Dublin to the coast, out to the sea. I could say Temple Bar, but
And who's the most famous person you've met or worked with?
That's Was I met the Pope?
What would be your top tip for, you know, people like me that have just started their PhD doctorate in terms of getting to grips with, you know, so I'm in mixed methods kind of ground theory territory at the moment, transdisciplinary, I suppose, in some respects. What would you kind of your tip for people helping narrow their research from being incredibly broad?
I think that I would lean into your instinct, and this is not a scientific response, but you have to make that intuitive assumptive leap of this is where I want to land. And this is, I've looked at all the information, almost like a personalized grounded theory approach. Okay. You're using your research to actually inform your hypothesis and, you know, back your instincts. Because if you've done the work, you know, audit all the information and think that's where I want to land. I would also say for somebody doing a doctorate, it's not a test of intelligence. It's a academic and psychological marathon.
I've heard that a lot of times now. If you weren't doing your dream job now, being a cyber psychologist, what would it have been?
I don't know, maybe medicine.
Okay. If I could ask you to tell me who you'd recommend I interview next and why, who would it be?
As Susan Greenfield, the neuroscientist.
Okay.
Because she's quite brilliant, and because she's been attacked for her opinions, even though she holds, wait for it, 30 honorary PhDs and has published a couple of hundred papers. And I met up with her when she was attacked. I took the time to meet with her and support her. And we met in the House of Lords. And I told her not to worry because the person who was invented fire was probably burned at the stake.
Yes, true. What book are you reading for fun?
I'm actually reading Jordan Peterson at the moment.
Okay, what's the book?
I don't know. It's called 12 Lessons in Life. It's quite controversial because he's got very controversial views. But I'm not reading him because I support what he says. I'm reading him to ensure I don't get trapped in a filter bubble and I read everything that I should.
Okay. Is there anything specifically you'd like to see change in our education system, you know, curriculum, devices?
I would like to see people at the coalface. The frontline teachers who are actively engaging with children, I would like to see them at the policy table. I say the same thing to law enforcement. You know, there's no point in having people 10 steps back saying we've heard, or maybe I would like teachers who are dealing with these kids, who are dealing with these problems on a day-to-day basis to come to the policy table and forums to say, this is our world. This is what we're experiencing, and we're worried. I would also like them to be part of the conversation in terms of influencing how technology is used in the classroom. I'll post a link for you to a very interesting European study that just came out, a large sample, I think it was 170,000. And guess what the study found? Was that children learn and retain information better from books than they do from screens.
Crikey. Amazing.
Exactly.
Please send that to me. Yeah, I'll tweet that out for everyone.
Exactly. You know, shock. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, no, please send that. Where can listeners find out more about you, your website, your books, any blog?
MaryAiken.com. I post all my research papers there. They can follow me on Twitter at Mary...
I've got the
spelling, but
Mary Sai. What's Sai?
No, it's Sai, but I'm just looking at the
CYPSY. Yeah, Mary CYPSY.
Yeah, CYPSY. But if they Google Dr. Mary, you can find me on Twitter as well. And look, I'm always happy to engage with people on Twitter. We found each other in cyberspace.
True, we did. Yeah, well, there you go. I've got one last question for you, Mary. What would you hope to be your legacy?
Creating a better cyber society and protecting those who are vulnerable online.
Fantastic. Mary, thank you for your time. It's been a real privilege to read your work and have the time to chat with you. I hope we get to meet physically once lockdown ends and we can either meet in Ireland or in London next time you're over here.
Sure, happy to do that. And best of luck with your doctoral studies. We need more people in this space.
Yeah, thank you for keep up the good work. And thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.